can't swear.
Because we are, no swearing. We are going to unleash a really interesting subject today, and I think we've got good scope for good debate. This has come about because we've had a few cluster members interested in growing different types of grain heritage or sort of wild farmed market opportunities. We've got a miller on our doorstep right in the middle of the cluster. We've got micro mills popping up. We've got bakers on our doorstep. And we've got every which way of growing grains in our cluster. So we thought we'd try and assemble a couple of experts on this with differing backgrounds and opportunities and so on. And Ian is going to chair today, which is brilliant, because he can see from this wonderful spot at FarmEd across the whole valley in every way it's been grown. You've grown it every way yourself. And obviously FarmEd is a beacon of this sort of knowledge exchange as well. So we're going to have a quick introduction from each of the panellists, and then we're definitely going to want to hear your thoughts and ideas. But I don't want to steal any more of Ian's opening, so over to you, Ian, and thanks very much.
Well done, Tim. Thanks very much, everyone. I'm assuming everybody can hear. We've got no microphones. We're recording on this little beast here, but actually, can you hear me right at the back? If not, please come forward if you can't. Okay, thank you. So my role is really to enable everyone to have enable them, strong views to come out. You know, I know there's strong views in the room. I know we've got some amazing experience here. I think there's a little bit of something for everybody in the conversation, and I'm going to make sure that we all get a voice. But I am going to have, because we've only got just a bit over an hour, Tim, isn't it? I think maybe an hour and a half maximum. What time are we lunching? Do we have
12:30-ish?
Yeah, that's fine. And if anybody does need, I know that one or two of you need to get away, so I will stick to times. But to do that, you're going to have to bear with me and allow me to rein you in as and when required, especially for speakers. So I think the speakers are known to you, but if you don't know them, let me just introduce them very quickly. Colin has been farm manager and agronomist and many other things at the Great Shire Estate for the last 14 years. And I'm going to describe you as conventional arable, if I may, for the purposes of getting the conversation going. You're much more than that. You know, you wear many hats, I know. Bertie, you're the sixth generation, I think, of Miller from Matthews Mill. You are going to give us a piece around milling, how that market sits. And we must remember this is a grain conversation and the markets for grain. That's all I'm going to keep bringing us back to. Charlie, of Ceres these days, I think you're the newest. I think you've got the oldest business here, probably, and now one of the newest. You're only 18 months old, effectively. But you cover a massive range of farms, and I'm going to sort of pitch you in as regenerative agriculture, if that's okay. But I'm also going to allow you some space around the wild farmed grain and things like that, so that we can talk about alternatives to market. I think the one thing that we're all going to agree on is that looking forward into the future, with all the economic and environmental woes that we know of and have, we are going to have to think very carefully about what we do next. And as these guys are going to start us off with, we know that it's not easy. You know, we're heavily invested. We are, you know, we're in this system, and to step out of that is really going to be quite difficult. And I wonder, Colin, can you start the conversation off perhaps just a few minutes on what you do at Great Shire, why you do it, and some of the context for us all, just to make us grounded in reality, if you like, if I can use that term.
Yeah, that's right. I'm Colin Woodward. I'm farm manager at Great Shire, also an independent agronomist for AICC on various farms around Great Shire as well. Great Shire is 1,350 hectares in total, of which 650 is arable. We also contract farm another 250 on three neighbouring farms around the outskirts, essentially of a ring-fenced estate. And then there's another 300 hectares of permanent grassland, which is mainly on the steep slopes and more difficult ground around the estate. We're quite heavily into environmental schemes. We've got mid-tier, high-tier, and SFI, which has just gone to SFR. We've also got a 60,000 ton commercial grain store, which was built when I first started in 2008. So that started with Frontier, then moved on to Glencore, and now with Sofitra for the last 3 years. That's split into various bays of 9,000 down to 750 ton. And at the moment, of the 60,000 ton, 35,000 ton has been used. We've seen a downward sort of shift of the use of the commercial grain store, mainly because of spring cropping, black grass pressure over the years, and segregating more crops within the grain store. So there is feed wheat, but we've got different grades of milling wheat now. So finding milling wheat is difficult for Sofitra at the moment, especially in this last season where protein levels have been difficult to get, mainly because of fertiliser price. And that's my biggest challenge is the price of nitrogen going forward and the use of artificial fertiliser. So our cost of production next year, the fertiliser price is almost going to be double what we paid for in the previous year. We've had probably our most profitable year since I've been at Great Chew in this last harvest. And we had our highest yield, our average wheat yield for Great Chew last year was 11.5 ton. We're just off the Cotswolds. We haven't got a lot of Cotswold brash. We've got a fair bit of ironstone and heavy high mag clay, which runs east to west through the valley of the estate. Where we have got Cotswold brash on one particular farm, we're growing continuous spring barley. That's made on a contract farm. It's mainly to reduce my risk. So we're growers of malting barley, like I say, Laurier. We're growers of mainly feed wheat. We try and maximise our yield, but we do grow Group 2 Extate, mainly because it's we can drill it late because of black grass, and then we grow a least vigorous variety called Dawson early in the autumn, and then we grow soft wheat Skyscraper, mainly because it's orange blossom midge resistant. So we're growing a range of varieties. We've gone back into oilseed rape this time after being out of it for 2 years. Oilseed rape's a high risk crop for us. It costs a lot of money in nitrogen and sprays. We've been growing peas and beans as well. But we try and sort of match what's going to go into the commercial grain store. So I talk to Sofitra when I'm sort of planning my cropping. And try and match varieties into the bays of the commercial grain store.
Colly, can I ask you about the economics, please? You mentioned your wonderful high yield of 11.5 tonnes a hectare, yes, which is incredible. Really incredible. But on average, wheat, grains particularly, what's your, you know, where are you margin-wise? I mean, can you give us an idea?
So next year our break-even price would be around about £160 a tonne. That's what that, on a 10 ton crop, yep, that is. So our fertiliser costs, depending on whether we're trying to increase the protein levels, would be about £500 a hectare. Our seed costs £100 a hectare, and our spray costs would be £250 to £300, depending on whether we're chasing black grass or not. Mm. So we're high input, high output.
Yeah. So how do you feel now with the wheat price falling? You know, and what appears to be a still high price fertilizer. I remember back 2008, yeah, when we had these high prices, then followed by, you know, really bad, you know, collapse in pricing. How do you decide on the scale you're on to?
I'm worried. As a farmer, I'm worried because we paid a lot of money forward for our fertilizer in May, June time, and now, you know, we're 10-20% sold at £250 a ton, but we're highly exposed to high cost now with risk of the wheat price going down. We're okay if we can get the yield, we can still break even, but you know, the margin's going to be tight, especially on Sea Grey, where we don't know whether we're going to get three or four ton, if we're lucky.
Yeah.
Our break-even price at three ton on rate would be £500 a ton. So we're more exposed on the rate than we are on the weight.
And you said that your £150 a ton break-even price for wheat, I think you said.
Yeah.
That's based on 10 ton a hectare. Yeah. On average, what do you realistically get averaging?
Our long-term average is 9.5 ton.
Okay. So, right. Yeah. Okay. That's really amazing.
Because we've had the bad autumns of 19 and 20, where we 19 we didn't get anything established very well for 20 harvest. So.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I'm sure the question of resilience in the farming system will come up later on, so we'll go down, we'll have that chat later on around grains, I'm sure. Bertie, can you tell us about, thank you very much, Colin.
Okay.
We'll come back, I'm sure, there are lots of questions. Bertie, can you tell us about your everybody knows the mill, so tell us about how you see things in terms of where we're at right now, what you do, the amount of tonnage and things that goes through the mill, just to give us a bit of a flavour for how you sit in the valley.
So first of all, thanks a lot for the invite to Tim and Matthew. Really appreciate being here, and hope you find it's interesting and the trip around the mill interesting. We're conveniently sat in the middle of, I suppose, all of you guys, which is amazing. We're really fortunate. We've been going a long time. What we do at the mill is obviously milling a variety of different grains. It could be anywhere between sort of 25 to 30,000 tonnes worth of grain per year. Going back 100 years, that would have been probably predominantly biscuit wheat, and then we did a lot of organic in the 90s and 2000s. And now we have a very broad range of grains that we take in. I should just point out that Mark Riley is sat in front here. He's going to help do the tour. He's the real milling expert, so if you want some real technical questions, ask him later. So where we are today is we do conventional, predominantly conventional, probably at least 70% conventional, organic, probably 10-15%, and then also now regenerative. And I'm not going to go into sort of what is and isn't regenerative, but it's a big part of the future. In terms of the grains that we take in, obviously we're a flour milling company. There's more flour that goes into bread than does a biscuit, so it's those high protein top spec milling wheats that predominantly that we're looking at, so sort of group one varieties, but we also take in group twos and group fours. So we will, as a percentage for bread wheats, what do you think sort of percentage out of that total tonnage for bread wheats? 60-70% bread wheat, which is really interesting what you were saying, which is if your production costs are going up and you're thinking, God, how much fertiliser is going up, do I really want to chase this? And I'll perhaps come on to that a little bit later, just a little bit about premiums and where premiums would need to be. So we've got a very broad customer base. Predominantly our main customer base is small bakeries around the country, 400-500 different bakeries, as far north as Scotland, far south as Cornwall, all over the place. That's really our, excuse me, pun, bread and butter customers. And then we also deal with retailers with home baking flour, and we've got 8 different varieties in a couple of retailers, Waitrose, Co-op, Tesco. That's a really relatively recent thing. We do a lot of sales online. And then the other market will be sort of wholesale and a couple of larger plant-style bakeries. Okay. Where we sit in the milling industry, there's really about 20 main commercial flour mills in the country. And I'm not talking about sort of the smaller water mills and windmills, there's lots of those, which is amazing. There's about 20 milling companies, proper milling companies, and we would probably sit now at the bottom of that list in terms of tonnage. We were probably second bottom until Wessex sadly fell, but now we're probably the smallest. And there's 5 million tonnes of flour produced in the UK every year. 5 million tonnes from 6 million tonnes worth of wheat. So it's an absolutely huge market. And it's a market generally where the margins are very, very slim. Because it's all based on economies of scale and the margins are very slim. It is a market that grows about 2% per year. The flour milling market grows about 2% a year, roughly in line with the population growth. So that's where we sit, that's who we are. Where we see the next 10 years is that if we're the smallest flour mill in the country, we cannot produce it as cheaply as the big boys, who are producing a at least 10 tonne of flour per hour, and they've got two or three of those mills doing 10 tonne of flour per hour. You know, we're pushing for sort of 3.2, 3.5 tonne of flour per hour, so we're a third of one of those mill sizes. So we can't really play that big commodity game. So where we're focusing on is probably two core areas, which is focusing on more what I would call speciality products, and I would define that as products that are outside the norm. So if I asked you all to name flours right now, you would say plain, you would say self-raising, you would say bread flour and wholemeal, anything that's maybe not those four or variations thereof. So mixing with seed and grains, using different types of grains, einkorn, emmer, spelt, durum, rye, whatever it may be. So one more on the speciality side to the bakeries and to the home bakers. And on the other side, for us, the key is going to be around regenerative agriculture. And I'll be careful what I say here, but I can see us probably dropping organic altogether if we can prove that a model, a regenerative model, is better for soil fertility. Because so I've got
well, that's probably a really good place to, yeah. to draw a line under that, because I think it, yeah, it will be a question that many people in the room are wondering. Charlie, I think probably this is right down your street to think about that dilemma between, you know, different systems. Can you tell us what you're doing these days? Because I know you've got a lot on your plate, and set a bit of context for regenerative agriculture. What have I described?
I see you missed that word out.
Commercial
regenerative.
Yeah.
I think there's a kind of key. I think that's very important because they're all businesses, so it's important to be a profitable commercial business.
Absolutely.
It helps sustainability. It's the first tick in the box, really. So I'm basically a crop manager, farm advisor. I've been working for over 20 years, and I suppose I was saying this morning, it's the first time I've driven into the valley and noticed sheep and thought, gosh, there are a lot more sheep as I came up here today, which is rather a bizarre thing to say when you're driving in the Cotswolds, so having been coming this way for about 14 years. I have a range of different systems, and I suppose I do have some organic farms. I've got some organic regenerative farms, which is quite interesting. We're just converting one 3,500 acre farm at the moment, which is quite interesting.
Is that going to be certified, or is
yes.
that?
Yeah, it's very important that they have the organic.
So where does the certification come from?
Well, who?
Who certifies it?
The Soil Association.
Organic regenerative.
Oh no, just organic.
Just
The regenerative. You're quite right, because and the reason I say commercial is because a lot of our clients or a lot of the people I work with, we've probably moved in the regenerative way because of other constraints, whether that's yield limitations. I was just doing your figures and working out, you know, some of the farms' average yields would put our cost of production at over £200 a tonne. You know, and today I can sell forward for 220 for November 23. So actually, we're getting to a point where a 10% margin is not very exciting. It's not worth the risk. And with BPS reducing, actually, we have to be really mindful of, what is the risk that I'm taking? Because that buffer of, the cushion of BPS has been, it's been pulled away. It's like the seats you made every sit on. No cushion.
Sure, there's a response in there somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah. Good. You can come. Anyway, so actually, necessity is often the driver for many chains adaptation. And I think this last season, with Colin's point about nitrogen prices being quite high, we've had quite a good open mindset from lots of our clients. Lots of the managed crop farmers we work with saying, right, how can we get more out of a crop? You know, can we put less in? And it comes back to risk, doesn't it? can we drop nitrogen? What's going to happen? Let's learn. So we've been in a real, really interesting place about working with cover crops, understories, different types of nitrogen mixes, bacteria, lotions, potions, witches, brews, you name it. Somewhere's tried it somewhere. It'll drop out of this box and tick another box. So, in terms of what we're growing. And the other thing about risk I've noticed is, particularly on the Cotswolds, so particularly focusing on this cluster, is I've got more white straw in the rotation now. We've gone away from pulses. We've gone away from oilseed rape. Much more to, how many straws can we get? And actually, it's where you've been, Bertie's been really great, because we've got different contracts for rye, spelt, you know, as well as the milling wheat. So it's much easier to take those, you know, those business decisions if you've got somewhere to sell it. I don't really like growing spelt on the open market. Actually, if I bring Mark up and say, look, can we grow some spring spelt or some winter spelt, you know, how much? So it's being able to work that in. So I think they're the changes that I've seen happen over the last few years. And it's just working with A, soil, B, you know, business, you know, conditions, financial constraints, clients' wishes, and the markets. Yeah. So it's been quite an interesting period.
It is fascinating, and I'm sure the change you described for sheep. Yeah, I think we're sort of at a point where things are beginning to change. But when I walk anywhere, when I drive anywhere, I just see monocultures in the arable districts still as they were. You know, I still see the black grass problem. I still see, you know, the problems with greenhouse gas emissions that we're all going to have to deal with downstream. You know, this is going to become reality. So what are you're advising a lot of farms, and your group is as well.
Yeah.
So what's the driver for the farmers to change this? Because if you're growing more white straws, isn't that just more monocultures and more destruction?
It's the way you grow them. You know, and actually, are they all in, if they're in a conventional system, which they might be. But actually, it's introducing cover cropping into the rotations. You know, soil health is soil and soil management has come massively up everybody's agenda. I averaged 11.8 tons a hectare. But somebody will beat that. You know. Yeah. But even that client, you know, she's very focused now. Actually, is that right? And there's a trig point in one of the fields. And you can see where it's put in the 60s, and the soil level's about this, much lower. So we've done something right. So managing soil, I think, is on everybody's own. So I haven't cracked it, you know, trying to introduce, you know, understory clovers to release some nitrogen to, you know, are they yet? No. You know, have we got the sheep management right on livestock in the system? No, you know, but it's improving all the time, and I think we're evolving. Mm. So what I haven't said is I've been a wild farm grower for 3 years as well. We've had them on a client, one particular client, and actually we've got a lot more mass market this year as they've sort of extended their rotation. So we've got them on another three or four clients, all between 30 and 400 hectares. So not just, you know, some are just dabbling. And I think even their system has evolved. It started very much as a pastoral system, lots of livestock, and I think this year they've realised that, you know, to get the market they need, you know, you can't just have a pastoral system. You know, it's got to be either bicrop or, you know, undersown clover. I mean, there's lots of different. But it's interesting. I actually quite like, you know, working with them. I think they've got a good team. A good commercial team. Harriet Cherry, who would be known to, she sort of is the farmer facing person. Andy Cato actually is absolutely fantastic. I think he's coming later in the year. He's, you know, he's a farmer, you know, he does the doing. He came and drilled some for me this year with a client, and actually, you know, he turned up in his Farrell's brand new kit. He'd spent a lot of money. Mm. I thought the whole system was trying to get away from paying the capital back to the machinery manufacturers.
There's lots and lots of stuff we'll unpack there. But so one thing I'd just like to ask you, though, Charlie, just to finish up with. So the margin that is obviously so important to everyone, and as you say, you can't farm unless you're in the black. So what I want to know is, wild farmed, as an example, well-farmed grain takes away the nitrogen, takes away the pesticides, doesn't have to be organic, as I understand it. So the yield drops. So Bertie, you're selling to a market that I know is price sensitive as a miller. So you're going to have, where's the margin? So does the price of food have to be more expensive? And I know that people have been commenting on it this week. I think Patrick Holden was talking about it on ITV this week. I know Jeremy Clarkson's been talking about it in the media as well. It's not a popular conversation. But in order for alternative systems to be profitable for farmers, do we have to accept the price has to go up to the miller, you know, and to the feed industry and so on and so forth? What do you think?
Yeah, I just sort of comment on this. I think if we look forward 10, 20 years from now, And we think of, you know, what percentage of the, you know, agriculture is organic. It's a tiny percent after sort of 20, 30 years worth of effort. And I think a big part of that is probably yield, probably price. If a new system is going to work, and this is just my take, then let's say that that is the conventional price of milk, eggs, flour, bread. It's probably too low, and we would say that we're producing the food, but realistically, it's too low. For another 10, 15p on a bag of flour, for example, I think a new system is far more achievable for the farmer, for the producer. So in the future, I think regen, whatever happens, it can't be above or near the organic price. That's an economic point of view. In order for it to work and really be scalable, so that we can see as much of the acreage in the UK as possible being used in a system that's developing soil fertility.
Charlie?
I think we'd love to be paid more for, farms would love to be paid more for what they produce. I think the reality is that supermarkets, governments, expensive food always leads to political pressure somewhere. We might not have a spring uprising in the UK, but they will elsewhere. So I think there might be differentiation in the market, but the mass market is still always going to be, fundamental. I think valuing the system differently is probably the best chance. And I know there are probably some people in here in the room sort of better place, but understanding the value of the system and the benefits it delivers. So if you are on a lower input system and you are building soil organic matter, you perhaps aren't using pesticides and herbicides, and we know they have a negative effect on other plants in the system. Those other plants are beneficial to insects, moths, butterflies, whatever, bees. If you create a better habitat, if you then improve your soil structure so water infiltration is better, then actually, I'm not going to use that two-word phrase that somebody's desperate for me to use, but valuing that system. As a farming advisor, I can't see whether we're there yet, but I'm a very, very simple person. I only grow crops. Somebody sort of brighter and better place for me will actually be able to put a value on that. But I think that's the real advantage we have in sort of potentially landscapes such as where we're at, is that if we can create a system that actually, it came out of one of the very, so Tim and I first met when I was asked to join them. Patrick threw me off the group. What was it called? The Sustainable Farming Trust or something.
The Global Farm Metro.
Yeah. And they and they showed a map of the, because you remember, of the Evenlode, and it was bright red, and it was showing the town line. And I thought, who's blamed for that? It's Velcro. Anyway, and it was pretty much. And then if you looked at the water coming down the Evenlode where they were testing, it's full of metaldehyde, and it was one of, and actually, everything's mapped in such simple ways now, that there are certain indicators. And I think, given that this cluster can actually, water's the tangible thing, but landscape, water, just biodiversity, I think that there is but that's a valuing the system, I don't know how we get to there. But actually that comes from a change in practice. Now, if you can then get a higher price from Mr. Matthews next to me, that would be really cool.
Yeah. I think the one thing we're all agreed on is economics count, and without that, there's nothing. Yeah. And that's the starting point. I think everyone's in full agreement on that for all the businesses involved. Open to the floor, please. I'll carry on with some questioning, but I'd very much like to hear what you think. We can pick up on any of these areas, but I'm not going to, we don't have the time to go into massive detail. So what we're looking for is markets going forward, from next year. We all know what a lot of the problems are. The question is, can we develop markets which are profitable, that farmers can adopt, and, is there a supply chain that will follow that? So that's what I'd love to know. Yes, question at the back there.
Where do you see your milling weeks coming from in this year, bearing in mind only 20% made spec, and as far as I'm personally concerned, I'm traumatically growing my German e-weeks because I cannot begin to compete with Collins at understated yields.
Very good question, and this is a big challenge for us, and it's a big challenge for Mark as well. I think it's sort of a number bullet point list. Can we get it from the immediate area? Failing that, you just broaden the area slightly. all mills in the UK will use high protein meat from abroad. Predominantly that will be Canadian, or it will be GLA-OE. So there's always a top-up element of it. It's sort of, I think 85% of the wheat that goes into that 5 million tonnes of flour comes from the UK. So that's pretty good. So the 15% is really made up of probably German, Canadian, and you know, before this year, East Europe. But that's obviously not happening anymore. So we will buy the 14, 15% Canadian, which gives us the strength. But we obviously wanted to get that what we call, you know, EBH, that top spec milling wheat for 13.5%, whatever that may be. We're fortunate that because of our size, relatively, we don't need a huge amount. You know, we need a huge amount to us, but in comparison to, you know, we don't need sort of 20,000, 40,000, 60,000 tonnes worth of 13.5% milling wheat. So we seem to probably do okay. Do you agree? We just about manage. The region might have to go a little bit nearer to the south coast or wherever that may be, but we're just about okay because the proteins were pretty low this year.
Just, Bertie, one thing that always bothers me is why do we have to have this high spec stuff? I mean, I know it's a stupid question, but the lame one, so lame one, you can grow wheat all this fat.
Especially when they blend it with non-red tractor accredited import, which annoys me.
Yeah. let's work that from the consumer. The consumer needs the demand, don't they? So it's the products that they eat need the demand. And, you know, we don't need pita breads. You know, we like big sourdough loaves that's got nice crumb structure. You need those two key proteins, gliadin and glutenin. You need that for the elasticity and for the gas air bubbles for the bread to rise. And we're obsessed with sandwich loaves. You know, it's a ridiculous amount of sandwich loaves that we eat every day. And because of that demand for that type of product, you need the high protein wheat. So it is consumer led. And I don't want to get into the conversation of, you know, we should be eating, you know, flatbreads all the time, because that's a separate conversation. But basically, because it's consumer-led.
Charles, one second. I think you're, you know, I get where we're at now, beyond 23. What's the role of the cluster? What's the role of this valley? What's the role of the miller, the farmer, the baker in developing another conversation? Because I don't see how we can meet our target, you know, our net zero things, unless we have a different farming system in the long run. And it's going to be made up of lots of different systems, I'm sure. But one of the things that can be difficult to achieve is this high spec we have right now. And I don't know whether I'm right or wrong here, but I just feel personally, in my view, that the high spec is very difficult to achieve on the Cotswolds without the stuff that causes global warming and all those things.
Exactly. It's a balancing act between we as a business, as a food production company, have to create a product that the consumer wants. But we probably make over 100 different types of flour. It's a complete nightmare for Mark, poor him. It could be much easier if we just did four. We can, within this region, this valley, this group, we can produce the grain that is good for the environment, yeah, doesn't require as many inputs, and we can use it to other products. We can use it for lower protein products. So if you think of types of flour as an example, any culinary flour, plain self-raising, biscuit flour, pastry flour, cake flour, spelt flour, rye flour, einkorn, emmer, durum, these are all the ones that we could be talking about. And if one of you does want to put a bit of nitrogen on it, which we're not against in the conventional system, then the conversation has to be, well, what does the price need to be? And I would ask a conventional farmer, look, we'd really like you to grow some high protein wheat. It needs to be 13.5%, 13%. What prices it need to be for you? Because we've got no interest in driving the price down for a farmer, because that's not going to help us at all. So, lots of opportunities over here with those types of flour. If you are contemplating a milling wheat, and you might have different soils, maybe part of your farm is on different soil, then we need to talk about economics.
So, economic Colin, could you comment on this? Because if you look at a corporation, think of their ESG, they're going to pass it downstream to the farmer eventually, aren't they? They're going to say, well, look, we need to be squeaky clean. Genuinely, the farmer needs to too. How on earth are you going to meet a spec?
I was just going to ask Bertie, what
your hands are.
How low can we go on protein to mix with the Canadian protein wheat? So can we grow 12?
Lower this week than last week.
Yeah. mix.
Well, I'll let Mark answer this one in terms of we buy EBH, so we're Canadian, EBH, and EBM. And we've been blending a lot of EBM, haven't we? So what is the average spec for that EBM? Because we've been taking quite a lot of it. Charlie said he was going to find us something.
I couldn't work. Yeah. 11.6 proteins.
So what sort of average spec we've been getting every year?
About 12.5.
12.5, yeah. So
we've had to come down.
Needs to be about 12.
I think we would, for next year, let's say we were having a conversation for next year, we could go, right, well, here's our 100 products, right, these are the ones that we can put a bit of Canadian into, and actually, what are you some local bread making weed? What is almost the minimum protein we require? And it's probably between that about 12 to 12 and a half. It's obviously harvest dependent. So if you're getting people might talk about premiums, premium loan about 60 quid, about 60 quid, if you're getting 60 quid for 13.5%, then what is the premium for an EBM? So it might be a bit below that, and so on and so forth. So if we all know this information and agree with it ahead of time, you know, it's transparent, you can go, right, is that going to be profitable for me? What is my risk? Yeah. And therefore you, as the farmer, can make a decision.
And the other thing I struggle with is varieties, where the group ones need a lot more fungicide now to control yellow rust. Is there any particular varieties that you favour in the mill?
Well, we take a lot of varieties. The top four varieties we've taken group one.
Nika.
Yeah.
Favourite. Pushout.
Probably top two really green crimson. That's Skyfall recently. And there's a new variety.
It's Palladium, Nelson.
Group two.
Have you taken any Nelson in this year?
Charlie,
the really interesting thing is, as you mentioned about ESG coming down, and actually if you look at, for those who have done a carbon calculator, if you look at who pays for the production of fertiliser, it's the farmer. The fertiliser industry have taken the production of fertiliser and it's allocated to the user. So there are two parts of it. There's the production and then the nitrous oxide, which is released. So we're already, you know, and I don't know when the tax will come, but there will be a tax. Secondly, so the producer is already sort of that. Second point is, you know, okay, albeit one season, but we could produce quite reasonable yields without, you know, cutting. So we cut nitrogen from, say, 250 kilos a hectare to 50 kilos, 70 kilos, 80 kilos, produce reasonable yield. The protein was absolutely, you know, dropped 3%. So you know, in-field trials, and we did 156 trials across the business this year, and actually trying to produce milling wheat, proteins without artificial end was really challenging.
For just a quick point on that, and it's early days now, I think what will be exciting in 10 years' time, if we look at farmers that have used this system, the key question I think is, what is the improvement to soil fertility in that farm going to do for your ability to be able to produce weeds? That will be really interesting. And some farms this year, we're probably 4, 5, 6 years into a sort of regenerative system, have had incredible results. But we can't prove at this stage that's because of their system. It could just be because of their existing soils. So hopefully we'll have more information.
Did we answer your question? Your comment?
Yeah, the other question I had was, you know, where would you class yourself, or where would you class our grain as regen grain?
How would we class it?
Yeah, because, I mean, there's people here who are in the SFIs, we're doing certain elements of it, cover cropping, log grazing, whatever you want to call it, min-till. People are going to direct drilling, but there again, we're putting more ferric phosphate on because of the slug problem. So I've kept a min-till policy across our farm. I haven't ploughed for 7 years now. But I'm not classed a total regen farmer.
Yeah, and I think taking a long-term view of this is key, 5-10 years, point one. Point two, this is a team effort, from the farmer, from the miller, from the bakeries, whatever that may be, and accepting that it can't be a hard and fast rule. You know, you can't put a for it, you can't put chemicals for it. It's not going to work. Yeah, we've got to adapt to the environment that we're in, the soils that we're in. So from a very top level, it's, can we prove that the actions, all five principles, can we prove that a lot of those are being inputted? It doesn't have to be no-till, it could be min-till, we talked about min-till earlier. It doesn't have to be no input, it could be minimal input, natural input. I think we've got to keep a wide scope for now to make it work for the farm. We've got to do our bit as a miller to generate demand, take a long conversation, it may take an hour, into a small snippet so that a retailer can understand what it is, or a baker can understand what it is. So we've got to build the demand, and in the meantime, together, we've got to accept, on a farm-by-farm basis, what system they can use, and then following on from that, the key thing, just in my opinion, the key thing will be in the next 5-10 years, will be how can we prove that we're making change? Well, something to sort of matter.
Well, we have to do that every year.
So you're already starting. That's the point. Which is great.
When are you? Where is your stage of us being what you need us to be DJ?
So what do you mean by stage in terms of?
Well, what, how far do we have to go to be classed as a regen supplier?
I think right now, if we can genuinely prove that that farm in that location with that name is implementing these principles, I think for the last year or two, then we can say that we're in very early stages now. And I'm not talking necessarily about the wild farm. we mill wild farm grain. It's a separate system, and I think there may be a system whereby there's sort of a wild farm growing way, and there's a sort of a region, or, you know, northeast cluster region.
Let's we'll shift on to other systems. There's quite a few hands coming up. Henry, I know you were.
I had a question about margins, maybe for Bertie and maybe for Charlie with wild farm. I think I got into a little trouble on Instagram. They took my post off when I suggested that they paid farmers £310 a tonne, and I suggested farmers took all the risk and they're selling for £2,000 a tonne. I thought that's unfair, and they milled at the Matthews for £160 a tonne. They took the post down an hour later and obviously didn't like it. I guess this is for both of you. You might buy my heritage grain for anywhere between, I don't know, someone might buy it for £700 to £900 a tonne. I've seen it sold retail for £4,500, or in little baggies, for £450 a kilo. That seems to me like a massive margin from a grower's perspective. Where's all that money going to?
I think it's a really good question.
But where's it, just break it down.
Yeah,
where's
it going So there's 2 points there. So one is the wild farm point, and we won't go into too much detail, and the other one is the retail point. So first of all, retailers, from the sales price, are going to make 40 to 45%. That's a big chunk, yeah? To get it to that particular retailer, sometimes you have to say, just as a point of interest, to get it to that particular retailer, you might have to pay £100 to £150 a tonne to use up an approval, which is the private provider, whatever that may be. So there's a big chunk there in terms of the retail element. From the farming element, I think it's really important if a farm like you is growing heritage grains, low yielding, that you've got to get a price that is relevant to the yield that you're creating. Otherwise, it's not going to be profitable for you. From the wild farm point of view, you know, neither Charlie or I work for wild farms, but for, on their price point, I mentioned to you earlier that if regen sort of fertility is really going to work, you know, my own opinion. Is that it's got to be probably above conventional, but it's got to be closer to conventional than it is to organic, because otherwise the market will not chew it up and we won't be able to get the acreage. What wild farm do in terms of their price, and I think now they've probably changed their price slightly, is that, yeah, on the face of it, that's very high, so I completely see what you're saying.
Where's that money going to? I mean, in terms of margins, 310, I've told them I'm growing, but it's not enough. Because actually, the risk to the grower is huge, because they're saying, actually, the principle is no nitrogen. So, you know, if you're moving into it further, they've dropped it by £100 a tonne. So it was originally, it was £400+ a tonne, which is actually, you know, is a bit more. Well, it's
Better than 310.
It's better than 310. You know, so I'm not going to get into where the margin goes, but, you know, in terms of actually, you know, looking at the comparative between what was conventional and what was wild farmed, you know, I think it's a bit more, you know, it's not as exciting now, is it? You know,
so what's the difference between wild farm and any other middleman agribusiness? They're just inserting themselves between the grower and the.
In terms of what wild farm, it's a brand, isn't it?
Okay.
That's what it is. I mean, let's not beat around the bush. It's a system that's a brand.
Yeah. Just to add a bit of fat on this, I think what's important to recognise is that
I mean, I think farmers get, roughly including the subsidy, about £9 billion a year. And the NFU often quote the food industry is worth £100 billion. Well, it is, but of course 90% of that is the difference from the farm gate onto the when we buy it. So I think Henry's point is really interesting. There's a lot of slack in the system total, which could be used.
Total income from farming, TIF, which is about £3 billion a year.
Mm. Yeah, if you buy it, take the subsidy out.
Total income from farming. No, that's including the subsidy. So that is...
£3
billion. Yeah, George Chisholm will roll that figure out. He's at Stratton Park. George will roll that out. And it's a brilliant stat, you know, every year. And it fluctuates by £500 million each year. But effectively, the old subsidy used to be what the total income from. So most of the farming doesn't make money.
Is there room there for a mill, or is there room there for a wild farm or an agribusiness that's a middleman to share profits with the farmer, because we are taking all the risks? So is there, buy it for us for £900 a tonne, a heritage grain, and then share the profits, because it seems like there's a massive margin there.
Okay, is anyone going to add something to that before we go on? Tim, I know you wanted to make a point, but add if you can to...
Well, I was just going to say, when does an independent certifier or someone that's going to bring credibility to that market become a broker or a middleman? Mm. Because I think you need that transparency, or you need the rubber stamp from an independent party between Bertie and yourself to say that that is growing regeneratively, so that you've got the trust. Yes. But, you know, and that comes at a price, it's the sort of association we'll know, you know.
Colin, do you think that will come? I mean, do you think that certification give the integrity to the product, do you think that will come in the short
term? Is that a middleman?
Yeah. Or is it, yeah.
I was going to say we're Leaf members and Leaf Mark, and we get nothing for that. So I worry about, if we don't get anything from all that effort we put into Leaf, and we don't get any increase in value from that, and that, if we could involve Leaf in it, I think that would be probably a good organisation to actually push it forward.
Fair enough. And Charlie talks about...
The system's already there, exactly.
Yeah. Charlie's talking about carbon tax coming, and I'm sure there's other things coming into the marketplace which will basically certify somehow or other that we're doing things. I mean, on that basis, then, to Henry's point, is there something that's going to come in 23 and beyond, to the point about markets for grain, that will enable us to do this, which will effectively certify in the same way that organic certification is certified? Will we have other certification that will enable us to add value? Because as you say, things like, you know, red tractors and quite honestly, it's not adding any value, is it, really? I hope I'm not being too unfair, but onto Leaf and others, but it does seem to me that we're not able to add, as a primary producer, we're not able to add value with those marks.
We're not allowed to sell for human consumption if we don't have it.
Say again, sorry?
We're not allowed to sell for human consumption if we don't have it.
Sure, okay. But how do you add value? I mean, I take your point, but how do you add value?
It's down to market, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is there space, though, in the consumer's mindset for organic, conventional, and, you know, regen in the marketplace? You know, people understand what organic is. It's a clear concept. Regen is quite a lot around that, and you know, even within farming, there's debate about what qualifies as been hearing. Mm. So, in a consumer's mindset, are they going to pay a premium to necessarily grow?
Just to quickly add to that, Aldi are delisting organic next week.
Oh, yeah.
It's like
interesting.
It's begun.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we overestimate who understands it. I think in Chipping Norton, you'd have a greater proportion than you would.
And then the other supermarkets are looking at a minimum of 40% margin on organic to then reduce the price of conventional in terms of the sort of ag convention.
What I think is interesting about this, and it's annoying about this because it's such a good system that should be used, is that unless let's say the Soil Association come along and they go, right, we're going to agree with these, we're going to regenerative, and everyone's going to sign up to it, which might happen, we don't know, then it's going to be led by a company or brand, and just because we've been talking about wild farms, they're controlling the message of the space. So in fairness to them, they're getting the message out there, which is great. And it's a bit like the sort of Actimel, the Yakult thing. I don't know if anyone remembers this. They sort of all talked about gut health and the good things in there. Actimel sort of went there first, and then sort of another company brand went, ooh, they're profiting from adding value. That could happen with flour and bread in the regenerative system if a certification body doesn't come swooping in. It's going to be an interesting 5-10 years, but
there's not a certification body. What's to stop a bad actor just claiming the product?
That's the problem. Because imagine if brands are doing a lot of good work, they're doing 9 things out of 10 really well, but 1 thing badly, and then something happens, then we could lose all the traction and the goodwill of actually something that could really make a difference. So that is a risk, a big risk.
I want to just introduce the other question, some other questions here, and that is, so I know one or two of you in this room.
So that's
sorry,
a really John. Good comment. You just and PepsiCo are going regenerative.
Yeah.
So PepsiCo have already announced they're going regenerative, except they're not, are they? All their potato growers are, who produce all of the chips for McCain's and all of the crisps for Golden Wonder.
They've made up their own standard of regenerative.
They can still use plants.
Brilliant.
Yeah, well, and then within the marketplace, you've also got grains being produced. You've also got grains being produced without glyphosate. And let's be realistic. So, I know exactly. Colin, your system, I would, and I say your system. I'm talking now about the global conventional system.
Yeah,
your system.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I'd like to know. You know, looking forward, I know there's one or two growers in the room here that have grown something like YQ, for example, as a population grain, and then have not been able to add value to that. And it's sort of sat in the grain store. And I've sort of watched it quietly from the sidelines thinking, well, that's such a shame, because in the same way that wild-farmed grain have said, right, okay, no pesticides, no fertilisers, here's a premium, it doesn't seem to me that people are able to add a premium to, you know, their own population or their, you know, a YQ or whatever it might be. And if it's going to the conventional system, and the conventional system is your grain store and your, to a large degree, because you said, you know, Bertie, I'm not knocking you, just simply saying that, you know, the mills are mainly milling non-organic, conventionally produced wheat. So I just see this as a big issue.
Blends, actually, I'll start with blends. If I haven't done YQ. Mainly because I couldn't see the market at the end.
Oh, that's interesting. So that's illustrated.
The blends, I've actually done a feed, because I think you get the benefit, and you and I saw that feed was on your list. But actually, in terms of grower management and risk, you know, and we've got a couple of clients who want to, you know, sort of, but they're feed producers, and actually, so we could actually, some of it goes to cattle bee.
Okay.
So there are feed homes.
Interesting. It just seems like a real barrier. If people want agriculture to go down a road of lower inputs, clearly they would prefer that. If you asked anyone in the street,
but then we can't sell it.
Exactly.
Well, that's
exactly.
Feeds the sort of
such a
low risk barrier, isn't it? Whereas Mark, you will say, what variety is it? And I'll say, well, it could be 15% Crusoe, 25% Malika, some Palifi, some Skyfall, a bit of Zayat, and you know, there's no, you know, you've got.
Well, it's interesting. I mentioned that there is, yes, we could create a label for regen, but also actually, if you let the natural capital markets do their thing, and you then get rewarded for regenerative practices through a sale of carbon, through a sale of water retention or improved water quality or whatever. So, is there a role? Do you think I know the market isn't stable now, and or established yet? But do you think there's a role in 5 years to 10 years where actually, you know, there's carbon leakage going to Canada at the moment. If we are merely bringing in Canadian wheat with high protein just because they can chuck nitrogen on more affordably than we can because they can extract fossil fuels more affordably than we can. And so, you know, once we start factoring the price of carbon into this, and we know that the price of carbon is going to go through the roof, and the fact that there's £1.5 billion being spent on insurance premium for flooding in Oxford at the moment over the course of the next 20 years, hypothetically. You know, there are various other actors here, so maybe we don't even need the actual grain market to do it, but you factor in the value of the natural capital market into your price to de-risk it, as long as we factor the leakage into Canada or whatever else.
Does anyone think that won't happen? Does anyone think that we will go on regardless without factoring in carbon taxation, natural biodiversity net gains? You know, does anyone see a future that carries on as we are, just out of interest?
It's how we get there most pain-free.
I think we'll have more slowly than people think.
Okay.
Especially with the current financial situation we're in, it's very easy when the economy is moving to sort of
think down the
Yeah.
John, want to come?
The word Canada keeps being mentioned, so I feel I have to speak. But it's more of a question. Would it work for you, for all of you, if there was a crop that produced wheat crop, for example, that was grown without any fertilizer, because we keep linking fertilizer with protein quality. It's not necessarily the case. It's not the only thing. It's about genetics. And obviously, that's been my big bit that I think we've painted ourselves into a corner in terms of varieties that are available on the list. So if you could get 15% protein, but only a ton an acre, as you do in Canada, would that work? I say that because that's exactly what we did this year.
It's a very good question. Because
in second year organic soil, we only get a ton an acre, maybe 1.2. Would that work? 15% protein isn't
It'd be interesting if we could add that variety into a blend of our existing
varieties.
It's already a population, yeah.
So that was a mixed variety?
That is a mixed variety that I put together. Okay. Well, mixed variety, sort of mixed population.
Yeah,
with many genetic
common to the back there,
heritage,
Henry.
And can I be heritage?
Can I just challenge, and maybe this is completely the wrong place to do it, this idea of protein levels. Mm-hmm. And I'm just basing this, not on science, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a baker, I'm just basing this on experience. And this person came to me looking for heritage grain, and I gave them a sample of a conventional blend which had a protein level of 10.4%. And they went away, and they came back and they said, we've milled that blend, it's the best milling baking flour we've ever had, we want to use it in all our products, and it was 10.4%. And I'm thinking, this is a very reputable big company. You know, I always thought the higher the protein, the more valuable the flour. And I think there's a conversation that we have around all these grades and these levels, and I'm not sure. I think it goes back, this is my theory, and I could be completely wrong, to sort of when the industrial revolution of bread happens, and
it's a good question. Bertie, could you just explain the nuances of that, but particularly around steel mills, stone mills, because there's a lot of heritage in this, and there's a lot of commercial reality as well with the tonnages that go through.
And my einkorn, by the way, is 17% protein, but my God, you could make a loaf of that. I mean, you could make a flatbread with it, but it's got 70% protein.
I love my question answered as well.
I'll try and address both about blends. Yeah, so blends in an acre and 15% protein, how can you fit it in, and about the protein of wheat. And you know, maybe I'll get Mark back me up here. So I started to look at those grain, we're getting grain prices, like, bloody hell, 17%. And then the quality is just rubbish. I think it goes back to the consumer demand. So restaurants, bakeries, small bakeries, even big bakeries taking 20 ton a month, 30 ton a month, whatever it may be. And they may be able to work with these fantastic varieties made by small mills, and I genuinely think that's a fantastic thing to do. But of that 5 million tonnes of flour, when you break it down into a chart and you look at where 90% of it is going, they just, with their system, will not take it. Because these big plant bakeries that make all of our food, it doesn't touch a person. It goes to a silo, it goes to a machine, and it's all built on these little algorithms that's built around all those wheat. And that's probably the simplest answer I can give on a scale version. On a local level, then I think, yeah, absolutely, you'd be able to do something. With the blend, and I might just need to ask you a question about this, John. So, 1 tonne an acre, it's a blend of different varieties, yeah? Different wheat varieties?
Different genetic lines,
okay. I'm just trying to think. So, 1 tonne an acre, 15% protein, as long as the protein strength and quality was there.
Amazing Hackberg. Incredible.
So yeah, I mean, you could probably blend it in, but you're going to need to at least, because it's 1 tonne an acre, you're going to need to at least get 900 to 1,000 pounds a tonne for it. And then it's a case of the availability. The other thing I was going to ask Mark is maybe, I know sometimes you don't like these blends because it's not, no, they're not as easy to mill if it's not just one particular type of grain. Because is that something to do with sort of the particle size of the grain, do you know?
Yeah, I don't mind, because we do mix group one varieties together anyway.
But they're similar, group one varieties, you look at all of them.
They're
the Lincoln Skyfall, I suppose, or Crusoe are all going to be similar types of grapes, but maybe John Mule, then maybe more variety in the shape.
I go back to the, you know, we're in the early stages here, aren't we? You know, you're probably not mills, but there are blends and there are blends, and there are different versions of blends, and if you don't have the right varieties in there. In you know, a field of 500 years ago, there were lines, we call them varieties today, genetic lines. It had incredibly good protein, but low yield, and there were others that produced big grains, lots of flour, that weren't so great. And we've just gone down the path, we have to have varieties that respond to nitrogen. So we paint ourselves into a corner, that's all I can say. So it is possible, but it takes time, to create blends that will produce good yield, reasonable yield. I think we can get up to 1.5. That's
my goal
in the next 5 years. But it's not only about yield, and it isn't only about protein. I totally support what Henry said. It's about protein quality, and it's also how you bake it, how you mill it, clearly. There's so many factors, and weather. So they all come into it, but I'm saying it is possible to have, I believe, mixtures that produce really good quality grain, but it so depends on the soil. You know, if you don't have micronutrients because they've been leached out by glyphosate, you have to say it. Sorry, regenerative, you know, there's an anti-regenerative movement growing that people want that clarified. It's very easy to damage a brand and hard to recover from it once you do it. But it is possible to grow heritage, but what's heritage? Everybody's claiming anything's heritage. I think it means something, and we can do this. We can grow grain that's really high quality, that has really good protein, and that will work for consumers. But my question is, how does it work on a large scale for large farmers?
Yeah.
It's about your margin.
Can I just get a straw poll here in the room? Who's growing, let's call anything between wild farm, grain, heritage, YQ, ancient, hands up that are growing that, or have attempted some of it? Actually, quite a lot of us.
Half have stopped
because
we were growing wild farm, the margin's not there. We right. can grow organic wild farm wheat, they paid us $4.50 a ton for, the yield in a ton a hectare. We can grow organic milling wheat at 5.5 ton a hectare and get paid £400 a ton for it.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, it's brilliant.
I think that's exactly right. Organic doesn't work.
I just want to stress my point about the genetics again, that there's a lot of social media and people on story and people, you know, talking about heritage and all sorts of things. And I have to say that's also YQ. What's YQ? And I've worked with Margaret about YQ, as you know. I know what it is, and I'm taking it forward actually in another blend. But it is the same varieties that we're going out. It's not heritage. Mm. It's just a mixture of modern varieties that are again nitrogen dependent. There are alternatives that we think are alternatives, but they're not really alternatives in a true ecological sense that we have to move forward with. And that's what I think is, you know, what we're missing is the genetics.
Yep. French.
How does it fit in?
Yeah. So I'll try to answer simply as I can. If, let's say, you can grow a really great, in terms of spec, 1.5 ton per acre blend, let's say it's 15%. If we use 1 ton an acre, I'm just trying to use base level price of like 900 to 1,000 because you count that back if it was a normal wheat. So, okay, so we can buy that for £1,000, it's 15%, and I get a ton of that. How does it work on a big scale? For the big mills and the big food manufacturing companies, it's like, why would they use that versus where else they could get their 15%? Canadian at the moment is probably about 400-ish, £400 per tonne. It was 550 a couple of months ago. So if you're a food producer, it's like, why would you do the difference? If you want to do something locally, you want to do something to direct to bakeries, and you say, actually, we're using this blend, it's really interesting, here's a story, that works. But on a large scale to 90% of the commercial businesses, I just can't see why they've made that decision.
And we all know if we keep going in that direction, we're going to completely screw the planet and everything.
I could agree.
So there's our choice. We want to be part of the solution and find a more local, maybe decentralized to some degree, but we've got to do that within a system where land is pretty much concentrated. But that's the growing market, and we're going to have to move towards it. We all know that.
And John, I can agree more, because for our business, I could have a really simple 2 years. Be like, right, we're going to do conventional. It's going to keep none of this, like doing these products, doing that product, trying to promote regenerative, keep it simple. I don't think we'd survive in 10, 15 years because the margins would drop and we'd be absolutely screwed.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask a question, sorry, to add to that, but also can you factor in, you know, you see lots of farms, not just in this Cotswold area, but also elsewhere. Give us some examples, if you can, of where people are stepping outside of the norm, still farming, you know, as we know it, but where there's some degree of success. Have you seen any, you know, can you report back from further afield for us?
I think it's coming back to the farming system, and Tim touched on it. You need the financial resilience, however you look at it, and it's, I understand what you're saying, John, completely. But you know, at the moment, there's much more of a challenge to make the bottom line work by jumping outside the box, because actually you're not compensated, you know, probably fairly is a good way for doing that, you know, because the conventional system is 99.9%, unless you're going to go and do it yourself, which, you know, not everybody can do. But, you know, coming back to what I stated earlier, you know, a lot of the work, you know, that we're involved in is trying to take out some of those, you know, we're trying to reduce the reliance on some of those, you know, whether it be pesticides, fertilizers, out of the system, and actually, you know, try and take out probably 100, 150 pounds a hectare out of fixed costs. And that's just not, actually, if I know, labour's probably increasing per unit, but actually it's, you know, doing things different ways. Mm-hmm. And that's actually what's, you know, it's just good business management. Now, if you can then lay on top of that, so like John was talking about with a, you know, getting a trial, but that does need the market to react to a certain extent, because of what you said. You know, if you can grow 4 tonnes an acre at 225 quid a tonne of feed wheat, mm-hmm. well, there's your £900 a hectare, you know, £900 an acre output. But the cost of growing that are higher. So you have to look at the bottom line margin. So, you know, at the moment we know that growing costs for that are probably £500 an acre. So, you know, if you can, it's about the margin down at the bottom, and that's what we're focusing on.
Margin-wise, Colin, I mean, you've been around a block a few times on this, I'm sure, you know, in terms of ups and downs of markets for grain. How are you going to plan? I want to go back to that question I asked you at the beginning about how do you plan for the future? Because you're on a big scale on a lot of big farms. I mean,
I think, well, I think...
What's your strategy?
A great shoe, we're lucky as far as we've got quite a lot of environmental aspects of the estate, which are good. So I've been trying to mid-tier, high-tier, SFI. What we need to be compensated more for the regen side of it, to go into it more. And I'm disappointed that we can't get make more margin out of what we do.
Yeah.
The BPS is the big thing for me.
When that goes?
Because we were £240,000 worth of BPS, we're now down to £160,000, and we're compensating with environmental, the three different tiers of Spain, to around about £100,000. So we're £140,000 short once the BPS goes, and that worries me a lot.
Big driver for change.
Yeah.
I think 10-15% of our clients are actually looking at it quite forward thinking, and they have, because partly some of them can, and what they're saying is actually we're going to take the, you know, split the two sort of lines, and whether you look at it as a, you know, look at the whole system, and I don't mean a profit and loss in a balance sheet, but actually it's quite a good way to do it with your system. You look at the bits that are the profit and loss, so, you know, the sort of carbon emissions, the inputs, but then the balance sheet is actually, you might talk your actual soils, your hedgerows, your woodland, and actually we are doing quite a lot of baselining now, and it's quite expensive, because to do proper baselining with integrity, I just think you don't get much change out of £50 a hectare in terms of you know, soil, you know, proper high integrity and soil tests, and one or two of them are going to, you know, and they're happy to take a financial reduction at the moment in terms of their physical P&L to sort of invest in their balance sheet of soils, you know, looking over the next few years, because, you know, some of them are in pretty healthy state, you know, 6-8% soil organic matter, which would be quite nice up here, I should think. But actually, even up here, we've had some surprises. Actually, that was the funniest thing when Andy came along, and they they like Wild Farm like to do a they'd like to do a sort of soil health with all the protozoa and the bacteria and the actually on the clot sort it was above average, which they were very disappointed with because I think they hoped to find something that was sort of so and it's just changing how we're looking at things, and then actually it's trying to get the value from that balance sheet, which is, you know, as you say, potentially from understanding more about carbon, soil management, water management, you know, woodland. And
So I can see that you described 10-15% of the farmers that you, you know, roughly. I mean, I guess that's the same with any change, isn't it? You're always going to have some people that are thinking generationally, thinking about their long-term survival. Not survival in, you know, like day-to-day cash flow, but longer-term investment. I think you're right about that. But there's also 50% of the farmers who are tenant farmers who are farming, you know, short-term FBTs, whatever it is. And they're the ones I feel like are in no man's land because, you know, they are really at the mercy of the markets. And many of those, some of those, I mean, we're in probably a quite high land ownership area here in the Cotswolds, but there are still many of those farmers here, and they're probably not here, many of them won't be here today because they're busy doing stuff, you know. And especially the more, you know, the more diverse you get, the more they're going to be, you know, out of this conversation. So I worry for them a lot, and I wonder, you know, what does it take to think about grains coming from this valley to add value somehow through whatever mill it goes through? What does it take us to, you know, enable that change?
That's a great question. I was going to say, what can the cluster do? What can we do as a hive mind to break through this challenging 5 years ahead so we're set up for the future?
Yeah. Comment at the back.
You mentioned the cost of buying in the Canadian wheat, but I can easily grow a German e-wheat at 14.5. My economist, I went to buy it from Paris today, it's on a very good year, I can get up to 15%. But yet, this coming year, there was no additional premium on contracts for growing it. So I'm back at sort of 250, maybe a 30 premium, but yet you're buying it in for between £400 and £500.
I'd happily pay it more if you've got any left. It's a really good question, and one we get asked quite a lot. The traditional milling view, of course it is you are buying from somebody and you want a cheap price. It's just basic economics. But in a year like this year, where the proteins have been quite low, my personal view is that farmers should get more for premium for it. If it is that spec, you won't hear that from many other commercial mills, I'll tell you that, because they go, well, no, it's that. But if you've got 14-15%, I have to give you.
Mark, did you want to comment on that? Wasn't sure. Yeah. Rupert?
In a way, we're all looking at farmers, but not looking at maybe so much as consumers. What consumers like, obviously, quite often is very cheap price. It's also flavour. We haven't really yet addressed flavour. So to answer your question from a moment ago, what could we do as a cluster group? We could, anyone here who grows wheat or a heritage wheat, John's definition, obviously, wider than John's definition, we actually can send our wheat maybe to Matthew's mill, certain amount each, and then you can bring it back here and ask your nice baker to bake a variety of loaves from each of the wheats, and then have a session the day after or that day. So we actually taste the flavour of the individual ones. We cannot be expecting people to give us grants forever unless we actually can link what we do to flavour and to texture and to aroma. So to do something like that, I think, could be a low-cost way of actually showing that we have common.
It'd be really interesting, yeah. Mm-hmm. It'd be really interesting to look at the different varieties. Generally, people sort of forget about taste and flavour. If you're eating a pizza, you'll focus on the pepperoni on top. But there definitely is with these heritage varieties. I'm sure John can talk about more later.
I think it applies to brewing and distilling as well.
Totally. So I'm
malting grains as well.
Yeah. So it's a good way to get the flavour. You could have brewers around here doing exactly the same recipe at low alcohol. And actually do the same thing again.
Yeah,
you really
need a
real
cluster. So don't get me on this cluster malt.
Yeah.
We might need a bit of malting
bun. Yeah. We're moving to 3,000 acres of directed grain for distilling in the next 5 years. And that's because of flavour. Well, it's not only because of the ecological story, but because of flavour. That's not an insignificant development.
Yeah.
Do you think it's easier? Do you think it's easier to add value on a bottle of?
Oh, clearly.
Yeah, than it is on loaf.
If you're going to pay 85 quid for a bottle of whiskey, I don't mind. I'd rather buy one good one for 85, the three ship ones for 20 quid.
So
that's
so,
my approach to this.
Yeah, but actually, why should that be approached? Be different to anything we consume, and I think that's a really, you mentioned how can they go.
It's made in a non-ecological.
No, that's what I mean. So if we can demonstrate to the cluster actually where value can be added quite easily, actually you can then come down. You build the, and it's tangible benefits. That's what the cluster needs to deliver.
But it also has to be real. There is that word greenwashing, which dare I be the first person to mention it. There's a lot of it around.
Yeah,
I think DEFRA won't allow us to grow genetically modified wheat, and I totally agree with you. It's down to genetics.
Genetically modified.
Well, it is because you want to change the genetics of the wheat plants, and
don't have to. No. GM is a modern plant breeding. I'm not talking about GM crops. I'm talking about the opposite of GM crops. I'm talking about traditional old heritage lines that have not been genetically modified.
Right.
That have not been intensively hybridized. Yeah. I'm talking pre-hybrid.
Right.
Because when they hybridized, I think they called it
long
crop.
Right.
Yeah. So no, not GM crop.
Right.
You're right that the seed can't be marketed, but they can be grown.
Yeah.
If you can get the seed.
I think worldwide there's something like five. It's an astonishingly large area of GMOs. We're not in that case in the UK. We don't grow them. But of course, they're all. I mean, basically, the GMO is grains. Is the Roundup ready? Plant. That's it. I mean, there is nothing else that's happening. It's very much that worldwide. It doesn't happen here, and we're unique in that. And I wonder whether the public, there isn't a market there, as well as flavour and texture and so on, but also around what could be a very unique local product. Mike, you wanted to say something.
There are a number of threads going through here, and I wondered to what extent the cluster should be a marketing group, because you've got plant farming, you've got different buyers markets and so on and so forth, the miller in the middle. There's a tremendous plurality which is too diffuse. To what extent, with the number of farms in the cluster in this area, should that be a marketing group with a brand identity?
It's a great question.
A really good question. Commercial operation.
Short answers, time sticking.
Short answer, don't do it. Focus on producing the wheat and let scalable businesses spend their marketing pounds and driving of demand. As farmers, if I was a farmer, I'm still well clear. Please tell my story, tell the story, provenance, where it comes from. Let the brands have probably got more cash, spend their money on marketing.
Colin?
What's
your answer to that?
I can agree with that.
Farm.
That's partly our duty as well, as a mill. Yeah. And then the supermarket's even more so, or whoever may be after that.
But then you're just letting the value go somewhere else.
Yeah. Not if you're the same team, is it? Whether you're selling wheat to us or to Henry, I would genuinely consider us the same team. Let us take that duty on in conjunction with your views and thoughts.
Okay, just rephrase it, not to necessarily to a marketing group, but a brand identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could happen. I mean, you've got to look at what else is out there. And I'd say sometimes with lots of these ideas, chaos can reign and confusion can reign. So I think you've got to take a step back, look at what's out there. Do you get behind something that has got trajectory, or do you want to be a part of something that is your own? It's a difficult one.
Alternative views and confirming views?
I would completely, utterly disagree with that. I think the more middlemen you can take out generally, the more money you're going to make, whether it's in farming or any system. And to case in point, the wheat that I sold, the grain that I sold to this company in London, I would have sold for £240 milling wheat, okay, and I sold for £1,000 a tonne to them. But I just took the middleman. And, when you do that, you see the cash in your hand, and you've taken all the risk.
If you can do that?
If you can do that, do it,
because that's basic economics.
I think what Mike's saying is that as a cluster, because we're a large cluster, why wouldn't we do that? Why wouldn't we take the middleman out and just work for the cluster as a group?
But particularly if you build something around it, like a system.
So that contract came through the South West Grain Network, which is a social network platform to allow bakers and people who want to get grain directly from farmers cutting out middlemen to meet.
So can I just convert my middleman?
You are, yeah.
Am I? So the source first, farmer could be the middleman. If people can do it independently, that's fantastic. I think it's amazing. If people want to mill their own produce, that's fantastic. 5 million tons of flour produced in this country every bloody year, so three times. Plenty of market for people. If you can do it, that's fantastic.
You're saying don't do it.
No.
You just said that.
Listen to me very carefully. Cash is finite. Yeah. Every business's cash is finite. Okay. If you can spend money on cutting out the middleman, having a I'll just use Henry as an example, getting a stable plant, going straight to the customer, I think that's amazing, mate. I genuinely do. Then spending a lot of money on top of that on marketing is huge. It is huge. And it's risky. And we want farms to continue. So what I meant was, don't spend lots of money on things like marketing, because it's risky. If you want to, great. Spend money on things that can come out of the middleman if you want to. That's great. That's great. I didn't mean don't do it.
I think Tim. In his defense, he did say in a very simple answer, don't do it. Because I think diversity is a spice of life, right? And I think with Mark's bakery, you know, emerging in another stage of life up at the Cattle Wells as well, you know, there is an opportunity perhaps to cut out some of the way you stop. But I think there's, we're thinking about flour markets here. Don't forget natural capital markets as well and the aggregation of effort. It might not necessarily just be in flour, but we can aggregate in other ways as well to give our weight as a group. But can I, in the last 6 minutes, is it worth mentioning the feed, animal feed element of this and grains? Because I know a preferred farm that use pigs or red clover. You know, do we see any change in the feed, animal feed markets for grain, or is it just going to be very niche for another 20 years, or do you think there's somewhere?
Yeah. Colin, I think probably well placed to answer that question in terms of what you're seeing in terms of grain movements through the grain store.
We try to grow rye, and there's not a lot of market for pig food for rye. That's been disappointing. Avian flu is obviously going to be has got a big part to play in the next few years. How that's going to play out, and then. The grain traders, they're using that as an excuse, to drive the price down a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'd like to add value to it, but it is difficult. I think if there is some element within the cluster group, we can do that. And was it 36,000 hectares?
No, it's 36,000.
I'll be a bit controversial, actually. We're all moving away. I think avian flu had a massive influence in Nevada, about 2,000 tonnes a month. So I think it was nearly 30,000 tonnes less this year just from their Brackley mill, which is quite big. We're all saying that it depends what meat as well. You know, it's a lot more pasture-fed meat, which we all know is more... CO2 intensive in production than actually feeding it for if you look at the emissions actually because of your slaughter dates it's more free to say there is a general trend away from feeding livestock. There are different ways of doing it, but it comes to the markets on livestock, doesn't it? If you can, it's about the value. If you look at the emissions, greenhouse gas emissions per kilo of feed is much higher from.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue on a singular argument. Personally, I'd look at the whole.
Don't. What statistics are there to make up good arguments?
Well, I think if you're looking to rebuild a farming system, you need diversity. So, for me, I wouldn't. You know, it's a bit like saying quite easy. But if you took out these things, you'd end up with no food system. So I think you need a diverse system in the UK. It's what it depends on, isn't it? Hence your comments this morning about sheep.
You know? I know, it's great.
So I think the question really is, back to Mike's point, how do you add value with the cluster? I mean, it's an incredibly strong cluster. It's probably one which, if it is the strongest, I'm probably guessing it is. So how can that cluster be used?
Newest for strongest.
Yeah. But how can it create something that doesn't exist today? That would be my question. Because I'm sure people...
If you have a vehicle with landscape recovery, you've got 2 years to develop a governance structure and potentially a second vehicle for this.
Potentially. Darren Wiltshire, they're on one of the Southern Streams clusters.
Yeah.
And actually they've sort of lost a bit of direction.
Have any of the other cluster groups done the thing yet?
Not on not on markets, not on food markets.
Yeah.
Natural capital, yeah, so EFG, for instance, Environmental Farmers Group, down that way in Hampshire, Wiltshire area.
They're focused on the chalk streams. Mm.
But I don't think any clusters have worked collaboratively to create markets.
I think with the group, which is an amazing group, going back to trying to add value, then I think picking one of these themes, and whether it's a regenerative product, whether it's a heritage grain type product, or whether it was something for brewing which has a bit more value because it's not a commodity bread or flour product, then I think working together and working with somebody who can turn that into a product or doing it together would be amazing, yeah. It's just a case of, do you do it as a group, and talking about spend, operational spend, marketing spend, or do you work with a partner? So, and there's cost and risk associated to both, but it's certainly possible, definitely.
Yeah, just
very clear. I think if there's a very clear definition of what the land use will look like and why the land is being used as it is and the benefits of that land use, people like to choose to follow what they want, but actually some of it will contribute to kind of lasting positive benefits, and I think that's where we should be aiming.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. We've got 2 minutes left for lunch. Make them fast. John.
I should say something. I'm just saying, addressing this idea of middlemen, and clearly I'm not a large landowner farmer, so that's a different perspective. But the one middleman I think that you have to be careful to cut out is the seed element. Now, in America, you don't often hear Canadian being so positive about America, but there is a public plant breeding network, universities everywhere, that are producing varieties and populations and all of this stuff. It's moving forward because there's a public interest, and it's funded for that reason. Here, they've convinced us all that what they're doing in Cambridge or officially is in the public interest, but it's not necessarily in the public interest or the environment interest, it's in the interest of larger grain companies, is what it comes down to. So we have a very, that's one level of middleman that I think we don't invest in. And there's no way for that person, those readers, you can argue, to survive. I can tell you that from first-hand experience. You have to make it from the value added to the grain, which you then sell right away across. And I think we're missing that.
Yeah.
I think we're missing a whole tier of middleman that would help us in this transition that we have to go on.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're stuck with what they tell us we should grow, and those varieties are chemical varieties.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I think that's why Henry's program at Bruin, for example, is really interesting, because it's actually turning over those stones. Farmer to farmer, peer to peer is really good. And I think I know it's very early stages. I completely get that. It's quite risky, quite pioneering. But in fact, I'm talking about the work that Henry's doing only because I've just been thinking of it recently when you were making your comments earlier this morning, Henry. But I think the idea of farmer to farmer in the valley talking to each other, finding out what works, what doesn't. I mean, because we've all had failures, we've all had successes, and it's like sharing those experiences locally, which is what, to your point, really about seeds and absolutely, yeah. But you can, as farmers, we are in a position to to get on with it, right? Any road, we have no time left, I don't think. Unless, is there anything burning? I don't know whether we answer all the questions we came with. I don't know. There's lunch now where we can continue the conversation. Thank you all very much for your coming, giving up the morning and part of the afternoon. Thank you to the panel. Very kind of you to come.
Huge thanks to all four of you, and Ian, obviously great, Ben, once again, thank you very much. I'm sure there are loads of better questions than that before you hand in your resignations directly to the CIC. We're thinking down the line we might consider this sort of vehicle. But we are testing the water with how we might get venison into the supply chain more effectively and efficiently, given the 30% increase apparently valid in locally year on year. So, and actually they're all, we'll talk about that one.
Yes, Wilkins.
Although not in front of me, because I've got to go out and shoot his road before I talk about anything else. And Mike's looking at me like I've ignored his requests as well. So yeah, that's why this aggregation of effort in the food supply chain is, I think, really important. But I think what I've discovered today is that grain is a phenomenally complicated one to tackle first, so maybe we take Fallacy first and work away to something more simple down the line. Thank you so much. We're now going to have a bit of pizza in the cafe, which will be fantastic. And then in an hour or so, do you think we'll get round in one group, or do you think it's better to...
It's only because it's quite difficult to talk.
Yeah, of course.
So Mark will take one group.
But I think it would be great if anybody hasn't heard Ian talk about what's going on over the other side to go and have a little look at your understone.
Yeah, just briefly, Tim, it won't take long because obviously there's not much to look at this time of year, but we have got a white clover underneath a population to look at if you'd like to. It really won't take long, it's just there, and that could be done on the way to the mill. If you want to go, maybe, you know, if anybody wants to hang back for a few minutes after lunch, I've got my wellers, I'll go. If you don't, I won't take offence. You know, it's up to you guys. As you know, this time of year there's not a lot to see. But it is looking quite interesting, and I can tell you, if you haven't seen it already, I can tell you that story in 5 minutes.
Brilliant. So half one, we'll have a look at that, and then we'll tootle over to the mill, and then there'll be a cup of tea after the tour. But Charlie, I think you're shooting off after pizza, so...
I'm staying for pizza.
Yeah.
He's done the tour.
Thank you very much. Well done. Thanks.